If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, still at the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, although there's a rumour going around this might be the last day. Coming up then on today's episode of the podcast, we'll bring you some snap reaction to Boris Johnson's big speech. Light on policy, it has to be said, but will the party faithful go away with a spring in their step? We'll find out. We're also going to take a look at the Cabinet, who is up and who is down after this week in Manchester. Henry Zeffman, Chris Curtis and Isabel Hardman cast a critical eye over the Prime Minister's top team. But first, we kick off with our columnist panel. Today, joined by Times columnist and Spectator political editor James Forsyth and Nadine Batchelor-Hunt from Yahoo. Could you two just talk amongst yourselves for a minute about what...
Matt gets his breath back.
James, what have you made of this conference? Ben Wallace was telling me earlier he thought it was all gone very well, it was lovely for everyone to get together, and the fact that they've announced some money for some tennis courts and new crackdowns so people glue themselves to motorways, we can gloss over that. It's nice for everyone to get together. Is that your take?
So I think that you might have expected a bit more grumpiness, you know, given that this is a Tory government that's just decided to raise taxes. That's not a universally popular decision in the Tory party. But I think that was counteracted by people's just sheer delight in being together again. Now, people might all come to regret this in a week's time, but it has been remarkable how little COVID has featured at this conference, both in terms of people aren't talking about it, but also, you know, you are not seeing lots of people wandering around in masks, I think it is fair to say.
Although that was also true of Labour last week, despite the fact that they all make a big fuss of wearing them in the House of Commons. They were not wearing them in Brighton.
You're going to see a packed hall for this Boris Johnson speech. People won't be in masks there. There's not been much social distancing going on. And I think that kind of sense of normality has cheered people up. And then I think also the fact that this is the first Tory party gathering since they got Brexit done, in inverted commas, won that majority, and I think that has created a kind of a good mood. I think it's remarkable that you sometimes talk to people and they're like, "Oh, I had to go to six petrol stations before I could get enough fuel to drive up here." But no one here seems to be blaming the government for that.
The thing is, it feels like, I mean, party conferences are always a bit weird and they feel like a sort of parallel universe, but you wouldn't know that this was a country where people couldn't buy petrol. They're worried about, you know, food, universal credit being cut from today. And yet people this just feels like the delayed party of the election win in 2019.
Yeah, so this is my first conference, which has been an experience. I went to an LGBT event last night and Liz Truss was there, like, dancing with people. But it does kind of feel like we are in a little kind of bubble here. I think from the alcohol to the food, it's very removed from what's happening out there. You know, there are like champagne receptions and stuff. And meanwhile, today, universal credits being cut. So there is that sense of a divide. I've spoken to quite a few Tory members. I've asked a few of them about what they think about the universal credit cut. A lot of them don't like it. A lot of them don't think it's the right thing to do. I think a lot of them expressed they were concerned about how we're going to pay for it. But I think they were like, I don't think it's the right thing to do right now. So it's been very interesting. I think maybe there's a bit of a divide from what members are thinking versus what MPs are thinking, maybe because, you know, the conference hasn't happened in person for coming up, you know, yeah. This is the first time in 2 years, and perhaps MPs have been a bit insular. I think at an event yesterday, I can't remember who it was, but apparently one of the members said to, a former culture secretary, you know, I don't like these culture wars. Oliver Dowden,
the Tory party chairman.
Yeah, and I went to an event yesterday on culture wars, and a Tory MP there who works in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport said the government has a responsibility to dial down on these culture wars. And also Christian Wakeford. I went to an event with him a few days ago, and I asked him, you know, do you think the government's levelling up? Do you think it's fair? And he lambasted the government and said, we're letting down children. The communication between local government and central government is crap. Yeah. And he said, I'd be happy to work with Marcus Rashford or Andy Burnham to help hungry kids, because it's never the child's fault if they're in poverty. So I think it's quite interesting. If you go into these fringe events or you talk to members, there is a bit of discontent there, I think.
I mean, it's sort of slightly always true of party conference that the more interesting stuff's happening on the fringe, James. But there's a bit, given the total lack of interesting things going on in the funny little auditorium where they've been making speeches, that's been true even more so this time around, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the conference hall, the main conference hall, is always more stage managed at Tory conference than Labour conference or Lib Dem conference. There aren't any pesky votes or anything like that to get in the way. I also think that because you've got a spending review coming up, this has been a very policy light conference. So you've not seen kind of big announcements of, you know, kind of sensationally large amounts of money or anything like that. So I think that is. That is true, but I also think that the kind of interesting thing about the party kind of working out where it wants to go, what it wants to do next, and I think this is a kind of interesting question, which is, you know, what is the purpose of his government? Number 10 are very keen to say that the purpose, and Boris Johnson will in one of his favourite phrases, double down on this in his speech, that the purpose of his government is levelling up. I mean, the big question is, how do you achieve that? And I think you've begun to see a little bit more flesh being put on the bones of the idea this week, but it's still a long way to go, and lots of the things they are talking about doing are very difficult. You know, but one of the things that Boris Johnson will say in his speech later is, you know, we are tackling the problems that other governments in the last 20 years haven't had the guts to do.
No government has had the guts to tackle before, which is a very interesting attack on his two Conservative predecessors.
Indeed.
Also, one of the things I point out as well, they keep talking about levelling up. I went into Manchester Central yesterday to talk to some just people on the street. None of them knew what levelling up was.
Nobody in here knows. Or if they do know, it's just their own thing.
Yeah, but it's like almost like their impression is a Conservative member. People on the street knew nothing. I had people say, is it a video game levelling up? Is it going to the gym and like levelling up weights? Is it levelling up an album? And I also went round conference and spoke to people here. None of them knew what levelling up, and actually a lot of them said they felt quite ignored. A lot of these people are working class people who are serving our drinks, who are cleaning up after people, who are serving our food. I went to an event the other day, and when I say people going weren't even looking at the waitresses and the waiters, they were just holding out champagne glasses expecting it to be refilled and weren't even acknowledging that they're there. And these people are working class people from this area that they're trying to win over. So I think there is a disconnect at what does levelling up mean? And I also went to a levelling up event yesterday, and I said, you know, what does levelling up mean for disabled people who can't work? Because we frequently talk about that. And one of the MPs came up with a story about a man with Down syndrome in America who worked at McDonald's for 30 years, and it was great. And if we can kind of get that happening in the UK, we can save taxpayers £2 million over the course of their lifetime. Now, I don't think that's going to resonate with many people in the public. I don't think many people are going to think they're okay.
But I think one of the things is, previous governments haven't not had the guts to tackle regional inequality. They've tried, but none of the things that they have done have managed to solve the problem. Yeah. And I think that is the difficult bit. It is not that no British Prime Minister in the last 20 years has thought, wouldn't it be great if we could make the North East grow as quickly as the South East? Is that they've tried all sorts of things. Remember Tony Blair moved huge numbers of government agencies up to the North East in an attempt to boost regional growth. And so it's not, you know, remember the John Prescott super ministry and all of these things. It's not that no one's tried to do it. It's no one's managed to succeed in doing it. And I think that is the challenge for the government. It's not that everyone thought, oh, let's not bother trying to do this. Everyone tries to do this, but they couldn't find a way to make it work. And that is the challenge for them.
And because it's so amorphous and because everybody thinks levelling up is a different thing, and you literally, you know, we've been out sort of fox bopping people, and you get diametrically opposed. You know, some think it's just, you know, equality of opportunity. Others think it's sort of direct investment and experience. Some think it's to do with schools, it's to do with transport, it's to do with housing, whatever it might be. But then, as a result, it's going to be quite difficult for Boris Johnson to declare victory on it ahead of an election, isn't it, James? Because at least if you say, we're going to hire 20,000 police officers, you can go to the next election and say, we've got 20,000 extra police, but we are going to level up. It's such an amorphous thing.
And I think he will hope, I think, that in 2023, 2024, it's enough to say, you know, we care. And a sense that, you know, there's more, some life coming back to these places, some more investment coming in, both public and private. But I think you are right that until you can say, here are the kind of three metrics or the five metrics on which we will assess whether the government has delivered, in inverted commas, on levelling up, it is a vague idea.
And when we get to the end of the week, or, you know, when you come in to write your column at the end of the week, or, you know, reflecting at the weekend when you finally got back and shaking it all off, what do you think this conference will be remembered for, Nadine?
For me, not much substance and a lot of rhetoric. And on a personal level, not fully understanding the levels of inequality in this country. I think that's what I'll be taking away from it. And as I said, I went to an event yesterday. In fact, I've been to three events. I asked Jacob Rees-Mogg, what does levelling up mean if you're disabled and you can't work? I asked Therese Coffey the same thing. And I asked, I can't remember the MP's name yesterday, I also asked an MP on a panel on levelling up. Therese Coffey and Jacob Rees-Mogg said we'd like to focus on what people can do and what they can't do. Although Jacob Rees-Mogg said, when I asked him, you know, people pay into the system their whole lives, do you not think they have a right to kind of claim benefits if they can't work? And he said yes. And then Therese Coffey also said, you know, we want to focus on what people can do and what they can't do. And then the panel I went to yesterday, no one answered a question on what it means if you're disabled and you can't work. So there are people who have fallen through the gaps. And Rishi Sunak's speech didn't mention universal credit once. Now, we know this is one of the huge issues. Even Ian Duncan-Smith, the founder of universal credit, has said we need to keep the uplift permanent. The fact that there are senior Tories saying, this is, you know, this is a huge issue, and it didn't even get a look in his speech.
And it's not featured in the sense,
I feel like there's been a lot of turning blind eyes, a lot of lack of understanding. So some of the people in their party as well, like when I say I've spoken to quite a few members, a lot of them are unhappy with things. You know, a lot of them don't particularly like Boris Johnson. A lot of them don't agree with the universal credit cuts. So I think for me, what I'm taking away is a party that is a bit out of touch at the moment. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, universal credit goes today, in a month's time, how they'll be doing in the polls.
What about you, James?
I mean, the most audacious bit of this conference is Boris Johnson's decision to lean into the labour shortages and the supply chain disruption and say, look, you know, these are a sign of a kind of robust economy. It's because the economy is coming back to life and they're good things and that they'll lead to people being paid more. I think that decision to take ownership of that is a big political gamble. Now, if he can say in the next election, look, you know, I ended free movement and British workers are now being paid more, that will obviously be a plus for him. But if this problem doesn't get solved because you're trying to do this adjustment all at once, as one cabinet minister said to me this week, you know, in the 3 months leading up to Christmas, and you end up with big disruption, this week will make it much more difficult for the government to say, nothing to do with us, or we did everything we could to try and deal with this problem. I think that decision is going to have a lasting impact on our politics, one way or the other.
Nadine Batchelor-Hunt and James Forsyth. Then, of course, you can read James every Friday in The Times. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, who's up and who's down in Boris Johnson's cabinet?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now,
Before we take a look at the Prime Minister's speech, who else has performed well or badly in Manchester this week?
We've got Henry Zeffman, Chief Political Correspondent at The Times. Morning, Henry. We've got Isabel Hardman, Assistant Editor of The Spectator. Morning, Isabel.
Hello.
And Chris Curtis from the Pollster Opinion. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Matt.
Overall, it feels like there's a big disconnect between Boris Johnson, king of everything. There's got a big gap then before you get to basically anyone in the cabinet. Is that fair, Henry?
Yeah, I think it is fair. I think in a weird way, this is kind of the conference that that the Conservatives were going to have, in 2020, the first one after Boris Johnson became the most electorally successful Conservative Party leader since Margaret Thatcher. And I think it has been an opportunity for a lot of Tories here to digest quite how brilliant he is at winning elections. I think that has contributed, there is discontent here among pockets about vaccine passports or about this or about that or whatever things that people have been simmering over for a few months. But in practice, they've seen him here. They've been reminded how much they love him.
Did you think the same as well?
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly helpful, actually, because everyone's very happy and everything's absolutely fine within this conference. And then when you talk to any MPs about how their constituents might be feeling, their faces fall and they go, oh yeah, actually things aren't that great outside. So they've had a lovely week partying here in Manchester. But I was talking to one last night who I think was sufficiently drunk to sort of say what he was actually thinking, and he said, it just feels like the calm before the storm, doesn't it, and something terrible's about to happen.
Chris, you're nodding. And one of the big, whenever we have a conversation about the problems the country is facing and the issues that Boris Johnson has, the obvious riposte is, look at the polls. They're still ahead. There's fuel shortages. They're still ahead. Labour has a party conference when it has loads of attention in a way it hasn't for 2 years. Tories are still ahead. Boris Johnson's still very popular. How solid is that, do you think?
I don't think it's as solid as people here think it is. I think that you do get a vibe that the Conservatives are maybe a little bit more complacent than they deserve to be. And you're always ahead in the polls until you're not ahead in the polls. And there's lots of reasons to believe that that Conservatives are going to have a very difficult winter and a very difficult few months. And I think, basically, they've sort of decided that Labour is completely useless and incompetent and sort of lacking any coherent strategy, which may not be an unfair criticism, but they've still got a fair amount of time to get it together, actually. In a lot of ways, Keir Starmer is still more popular than the Prime Minister in a lot of polling, and that's often a point that's forgotten. And I don't think their current lead in the polls, which after all in many polls is sort of small, the sort of lead that would lead to a hung parliament, I don't think that's as stable as they think it is.
And there is always the risk as well that they think that the people here think the Labour Party is so rubbish that they can afford to essentially be a bit rubbish themselves. And Boris Johnson can make jokes about pigs because he thinks, well, the Labour Party aren't capitalising. But anyway, let's work our way through the cabinet. And we're paying particular attention as well to the Conservative Home. So the Conservative Home is a website for Conservative Party members. They do a survey every month asking which members of the cabinet they particularly like. Liz Truss is miles ahead in these net satisfaction ratings for the cabinet. So let's start with the new Foreign Secretary. Let's take a listen to her making a speech this week.
My vision is to strengthen our economic and security ties in order to build a network of liberty around the world. We will have a positive, patriotic, proactive foreign policy that expands our trade routes, strengthens our security partnerships, and supports development.
Isabella, a network of liberty, a pragmatic, proactive policy, foreign policy, in which you didn't mention Europe at all.
Yes, it was funny. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of being back in year 9 at girls' school, where people sort of talked about their friends while very pointedly avoiding one name, just to show how really mean they were. But look, it obviously went down well in the hall. It was appointed a mission that was designed to appeal to the members. Actually, I know we're going to talk about his speech separately, but I thought it was notable also that Rishi Sunak talked about his very brave decision to back Brexit, which, obviously destroyed his career thereafter.
Oh, good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. It's Matt Chorley in Manchester. What I've done here, this is a terrible error. I've got myself in a sort of group behind Rishi Sunak, who's about to walk out and have his photo. I'm going to wait here. Yeah. Hey, Rishi, do you get fed up with doing all these selfies?
No, it's great, actually.
You're like a rock star.
It is just...
you're more popular than Andy Burnham was last week. Which means you've had to put some trousers on. Now,
I thought the quality of the speeches in the hall yesterday was utterly lamentable.
The only two people who are awake and sober in Manchester awake. They are awake.
I had to do an unthinkable thing, Matt. I had to go and find a physical Tory party press officer.
Andrew is ahead. Kieran needs to pull it out of the bag here if he's going to chat. Oh, it's very close. It is very close. Oh, it's a photo finish. It is a photo finish. Eggs have been dropped. Eggs have been dropped all over the back of the Daily Politics. You put BBC Two on, you will...
Oh, lively behind us.
I can't remember. Who did I say won that?
First of all, it's not the Daily Politics.
I know, I'm sorry.
I mean, you know,
it's really, only been about, 5 years?
Yeah, 5 years. You're a slow learner.
What about Theresa May?
Yeah, she kind of resembles Ted Heath in a skirt.
Maybe there's a connection between getting people who are really hungover to do the quiz means they don't get part the correct answer was the Rover's Return. Don't say that on the radio! Up until now, but anyway, it's nice to hear the montage again. It's Matt Jolly live in Manchester. We've pulled the yoghurt pots and the string nice and tight now, so hopefully you'll be able to stick with us. I think you heard the extract of Liz Truss's speech, and we've been quite happily talking about it ever since without realising that nobody else was listening. Isabel, first of all, what's your take on Liz Truss? There's a slight feeling I've picked up from people in around conference. It's all a little bit calculated. I won't mention Europe. And everyone will notice that. And isn't that very clever of me?
Yeah, I mean, that was quite Mean Girls, wasn't it? The sort of, you know, year nine at all girls school, not really, you know, talking about all the people you like and omitting the one person in the class who you really hate in a very pointed way. And I mean, I also think that in terms of the sort of public perception of her, it's not so much the cold pizza posts on Instagram. It's still that is a disgrace cheese speech that everyone's obsessed with. I mean, she's got her own gift section on WhatsApp, for instance. When maybe this is just shows how weird my friends are, that when they're talking about something being bad, Liz Truss pops up in gift form saying that is a disgrace about cheese again.
Henry, what's your take on her?
I actually think this was this was a conference for Liz Truss, which actually shows that she might have some difficulties retaining her affections, or retaining the affection, or the intensity of the affection of conservative activists, because foreign policy is fundamentally quite dull, and her speech went down pretty well in the hall, but it wasn't rapturously received. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a reception which made you think, wow. You know, this woman is going to be Tory leader for sure, in the way that some of those Boris Johnson speeches did make you think, okay, you know, this man could be unbeatable in a leadership election. I think it'll be difficult for Liz Truss to, you know, while she is being Britain's chief diplomat, to keep talking about the issues that are red meat for Conservative activists. And I think actually you've seen a bit of that this week.
Chris, from a polling perspective, away from the Con Home survey, does Liz Truss have any impact on the public consciousness?
Not beyond the sort of GIF phenomenon that Isabel mentioned, I don't think. No, I mean, the public can name Boris Johnson. Most of the public can name Rishi Sunak. I think beyond that, it's very, very hard for a cabinet member to be sort of a household name.
Well, listen, that's Liz Truss and the Foreign Secretary. Let's turn our attention to her predecessor, famously, although they're still squabbling over who gets chevening. Dominic Raab, Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Chancellor, and Law and Justice Secretary, of course, to give him his full title. This was him in his speech earlier this week.
But friends, there is one area where we've got to do a whole lot better. Like I know all of you, I was shocked and horrified by the harrowing murders of Sarah Everard and Sabina Nest. These cases have quite understandably sparked a national outpouring of fear and anger, because they go to the very heart of the society that we all want to live in, and that we want for our children and for the next generation. So I can tell you that making our communities safer so that women can walk home at night without having to look over their shoulder, as your Justice Secretary, that is my number one priority.
So that's Dominic Raab there talking about violence against women, although he seems to have gone to a bit of a pickle this morning. He was on BBC Breakfast and was pressed on whether misogyny should be a hate crime, and said misogyny is absolutely wrong, whether it's a man against a woman or a woman against a man. Isabel.
Spectacular definition of misogyny. I think, though...
Does he think he means just, like, badness? Badness is bad, whoever's doing it.
I've watched the clip several times because I've become obsessed with it this morning. And a kind interpretation would be he does say the word insults and misogyny. And I wondered whether he was trying to say that. A less kind and possibly more realistic interpretation is that he doesn't know what he's saying.
I heard one person try to explain there was a comma there somewhere.
I think he did get quite good standing within the conference. He's part of the Law and Order push, and even though sort of popularly he's known as the guy who went on holiday while the Taliban advanced across Afghanistan, I think the fact that he was allowed to make announcements shows that Boris Johnson rates him, because lots of cabinet ministers got up on that weird stage in that weird little hall this week and said absolutely nothing, including Michael Gove.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, big senior figures. Some of them didn't even get speeches. They had these weird panel discussions where they had a Q&A from the audience. And all the questions were things like, what is your favourite bit of your job?
You had to send them in via WhatsApp, didn't you? And that was how you got selected. So you didn't even get...
There was no show of hands.
So people actually asking difficult questions. I'll tell you what, let's move on from Dominic Raab for a moment. Let's take a listen to Rishi Sunak. Obviously, Chancellor of the Exchequer. Quite a big moment, his first in-person party conference speech. Let's take a listen to him.
Remember, as economies around the world pulled the shutters down, forecasters were predicting unemployment to reach 12%. Millions of people were on the precipice of losing their jobs, their livelihoods, their homes. Well, the forecasts were wrong. The unemployment rate is at less than 5% and falling. That's lower than France, America, Canada, Italy and Spain. And we now have one of the fastest recoveries of any major economy in the world. Now, it wasn't that the forecasters had bad models, no. It's just their models did not take account of one thing. And that was this Conservative government, our will to act, and our plan to deliver.
He also set out the defence of tax rises.
And whilst I know tax rises are unpopular, some will even say unconservative, I'll tell you what is unconservative. Unfunded pledges, reckless borrowing and soaring debt. Anyone who tells you that you can borrow more today and tomorrow will simply sort itself out just doesn't care about the future. So yes, I want tax cuts, but in order to do that, our public finances must be put back on a sustainable footing.
Well, it's quite an audacious move, that, Henry Zeffman. Rishi Sunak making the case that tax rises are the conservative thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, the whole speech was sort of casting himself as the man who, you know, had no option but to take the difficult choices to save jobs. But on tax cuts in particular, of course, I mean, that is the recent tax rise is something that conservative activists are a bit concerned about. And if there's one thing we know Rishi Sunak is concerned about, it's his popularity with the Conservative Party, not just MPs, but activists more generally. And as you mentioned, I mean, shouldn't lose sight, this was basically his debut on that stage. 2 years ago, Rishi Sunak was Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and I think it's fairly charitable to suggest that even, you know, a small handful of activists would have known who he was. You know, it was a big moment for him. I have to say, I thought he did very well. You know, I heard a bit of the clip there. His delivery was very good. It was all very plausible. The problem for Rishi Sunak this week is that Boris Johnson is so popular. So all this sort of soft soap videos and all of that, that's not going to matter for quite a few years, I think.
Although he has been, whenever I've seen Rishi Sunak walking about, he is the one that everyone wants a selfie with. There was a very awkward moment one day this week when I was walking out of here. Rishi Sunak was ahead of me, being mobbed. Dominic Raab comes the other way and basically has to sort of walk around a group of people wanting selfies.
As if they don't know he's the Deputy Prime Minister and was recently promoted.
In fairness, if it were me, I would much prefer a selfie with Rishi Sunak than Dominic Raab, because as a 5'8" man, it's comparatively look a little bit taller. I think that clip you showed about tax rises there, you talk about the Conservative Party membership and that, but that quote, that line is exactly where the country is. And I still think with this tax rise and all of this stuff about is it left-wing, right-wing, regardless of that, it's a very, very good dividing line with the Labour Party. We've got putting more money into the NHS and social care, and we're telling you where that's coming from. The Labour Party says it's going to do that, but where's it going to come from? What magic money tree is it going to come from? And ultimately, whenever you run focus groups, whenever you talk to voters, whenever you ask people what their biggest problem with the Labour Party is, it's not the culture war stuff, it's not the woke wars that maybe many people at this conference think it is. It's that they think they're going to rack up the debt and deficit, cause more recessions, can't run the economy, completely incompetent at doing that. And like that sort of stuff helps bring that message back. And puts Labour in a very, very difficult position. And I think actually that's the strategic achievement that tax rise achieved, almost more than anything else.
My favourite line from Rishi Sunak's speech was when he said, "My point is this, even if you can't see it yet, I assure you the future is here." Which is all a bit Keir Starmer bending the arc of history for my liking, but anyway, it's all a bit time jump. Right, still to come, we're going to take a look at Priti Patel and Michael Gove as we work out who's up and who's down in the cabinet here on Times Radio.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Yeah, morning. It's Matt Chorley live from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, ahead of Boris Johnson's speech, which is coming up live at 11:30. If he's on time. We'll bring you to that live. We'll be taking a look at some of the speeches of his top team, the Cabinet, who's up and who's down. Let's turn our attention now to the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who actually, I think, probably had one of the biggest announcements of the conference this week. Let's take a listen.
It is abhorrent that a serving police officer was able to abuse his position of power, authority and trust to commit such a horrific crime. The public have a right to know what systematic failures enabled his continued employment as a police officer. We need answers as to why this was allowed to happen. I can confirm today that there will be an inquiry to give the independent oversight needed to ensure that something like this can never happen again.
That's Priti Patel there. The thing that struck me was at the weekend, the government was saying they weren't going to order an inquiry.
Mm.
And part of me wondered, from a purely cynical political perspective, why not announce this last week?
Yeah, I thought the delay was very strange because it left a vacuum into which we had all that very strange advice about, you know, if women were accosted by a lone police officer, they should start waving at bus drivers, which, I mean, as someone who's had bus drivers go past them quite a lot of time when I'm actually at a bus stop, I found slightly slightly bizarre. But so that was odd. But I do think, you know, that aside, the way she managed to get the balance there between announcing this inquiry, saying that what had happened was, you know, disturbing and unacceptable, but also not just bashing the police because she still wants to seem on the side of the police. It was a very difficult, delicate balance. She managed to do that and then move on to the much more political sort of raw bits of her speech where she talked about protests and talked about sentencing and all those sorts of things, immigration, the asylum system. There were lots of difficult things for her to juggle. I mean, that's the very nature of a Home Secretary's job, is there's always something going wrong somewhere. And for her, basically, everything is going wrong on every front. And so the sort of theme of her speech, I wrote about this yesterday and then I accidentally encountered her at a party and felt slightly shamefaced, was sort of large and in charge, which, I mean, she's not very large. She's quite short, actually. But, but it was sort of, I'm in control. I'm taking control over the immigration system. I'm going to crack down on these people who are getting in the way of, you know, ambulances on the motorway and so on. Get out of my way. I'm Priti Patel, basically.
And does that play well with voters, Chris?
What we've noticed in particular, I think, and it's one area where Priti is going to have a big role in coming years, is on the issue of crime and violent crime. And it is going up the public's consciousness. It's increasingly one of the top three issues facing the countries in the sort of polling issues trackers that we do. And we've also seen Labour, you know, perhaps not particularly successfully so far, but try to sort of make themselves the party that's best placed.
Whether it's having an impact, that they have at least identified that. That Nick Thomas Simmons last week, the shadow Home Secretary, we literally dusted off Tony Blair's tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. They've realised that is somewhere where there is political potential.
Yeah, well, actually, I think one of the difficulties for the Labour Party is that they'll never be able to come out with a better slogan on crime than tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, so they're just going to have to keep
really,
using...
really, really, really tougher on crime.
Really tough.
But yes, ultimately, Labour realises that this is one of the ways they can sort of again show they're in touch with those more socially conservative voters who have moved away from them in recent years, and I think therefore that is a problem for the Conservative Party and one that they're going to have to make sure they keep the Labour Party off that lawn.
Henry, how's Priti Patel seen? Because she's obviously clearly very popular with the activists. She's definitely had the biggest rounds of applause. Sitting here from you'll be able to hear from the hall at the other end. How would she sort of get on with her cabinet colleagues and MPs and that sort of thing? Because there is also this criticism. She keeps announcing things, particularly about how to deal with the migrants crossing the channel. She makes more and more announcements, and the numbers just keep going up.
Yeah, I'm not sure she's either hugely popular or unpopular with her cabinet and MP colleagues. I mean, I think actually she's not, despite clearly having leadership ambitions in the sort of Boris Johnson, if the ball came loose from the scrum sense. I don't think she is constantly manoeuvring. She's not one of those who's holding drinks parties left, right and centre. I think her strength actually comes from her ideology, which is that she is clearly on the right of the party, clearly a true believer in a way that some of her colleagues are not. And that's the strength she derives, is the fact that she can say these things that to a degree any Conservative Home Secretary would say, and get far, far more applause and go down really well because it's so clear that's what Priti Patel is actually about.
OK, let's take a look at the last of the big hitters, probably the longest job title of any of them. Michael Gove, Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities and Minister for Intergovernmental Relations. I bumped into him last night and I said, basically, if you spend your entire week with people telling you what levelling up is, and he said he could probably do a whole episode of Just a Minute on his own, just talking about levelling up without any repetition or deviation at all. Anyway, let's take a listen. This was Michael Gove in his speech trying to define levelling up.
And for the government, levelling up means four things. We want to strengthen local leadership. Great mayors like Andy Street driving real change. We also want to raise living standards, especially where they're lower. We want to improve public services, especially where they're weaker. And we also want to give people the resources necessary to enhance a sense of pride in the place where they live.
Michael Gove's definition of levelling up, then. Does it mean anything to anyone, Chris?
No, I asked. Is there a song called Level Up?
Yeah, there is.
Level up.
It's very big on the TikTok.
Yeah, that was basically, I went around some of my colleagues in my office who don't work in political research the other day, and that was when I asked them what levelling up was. That was the biggest response I got back. Out of all of the sort of, I think the Conservatives have been sort of quite good at different sort of political strategies over the past few years. This is the one I'm actually, sort of levelling up agenda is the one I'm most cynical about, because I think it'd be very, very difficult for the Conservatives to turn around to voters in some of those seats in a few years' time and, make the argument that they've materially improved their communities and their lives. That's a very, very hard argument to do. It's usually better to find someone else to blame or say, well, at least the other guys aren't going to do a better job.
And also there were 60 million different definitions of
that.
One person wants their park sorted out, somebody else wants the pothole sorted. There's so many improving the area you live in.
Yeah, and people are going to, in a few years' time, people are still going to drive to their local high street and their car is going to hit a pothole and then they'll get to the local high street and there will still be shops empty. And then they'll go for a walk in the park and there'll still be too much litter in the park. And, actually it's very, very hard to make the argument that you have made these kind of differences and made these kind of changes. And people notice negative things more than they notice positive things and all of that other stuff about human psychology. So I'm still not convinced that levelling up is, even if they do end up doing quite a good job at it, is a particularly good, useful political strategy for the Conservatives or narrative that they want to be telling.
Yeah, I mean, if Michael Gove were playing Just a Minute in his speech, one of the rules must also, along with repetition and so on, be don't make any announcements, because he didn't actually say anything. And, if they want concrete things to be happening, then they haven't got much time. And perhaps in the next couple of minutes, Boris Johnson is going to announce all sorts of things that will see the cranes driving north to build, build this new Jerusalem. They haven't got much time, and they're not going to improve schools in 2 years. They're not going to, build lots of bridges or whatever in 2 years. So what are they going to do?
But the whole conference has been really announcement free. Mm. I mean, we're looking at these two big banners, delivering on the people's priorities and getting on with the job. But I do think midterm, Boris Johnson's still a little bit hazy on what the job is.
There's also Build Back Better.
Oh, yeah, so there is. Well, again.
Three slogans,
none of which mean a huge amount.
Still a tenth of the number Labour had over the course of their conference.
So they've all packed up, cleared off, taken their hangovers and headed for the train. The Conservatives leaving Manchester after their first in-person conference for 2 years. But how did Boris Johnson's speech go down? Let's ask the panel. I'm joined by Patrick Maguire, Times Red Box editor, Isabel Harman from The Spectator and Chris Curtis from the Pollster Opinion. Let's start with you, first of all, Isabel. And the sense that this felt a bit like it was delayed by a year because of the pandemic, but a bit of a victory lap and a bit of a triumphant, belated electoral victory rally. Let's take a listen to Boris Johnson talking about building back better.
After decades of drift and dither, this reforming government, this can-do government, this government that got Brexit done, that's getting the COVID vaccine rollout done, is going to get social care done. And we are going to deal with the biggest underlying issues of our economy and society, the problems that no government has had the guts to tackle before. And I mean the long-term structural weaknesses in the UK economy.
Isabel Harman, what do you make of it?
I mean, I don't think it bore much relation to reality, not just in terms of what's going on outside the conference hall in terms of the supply chain shortages and so on, but also in terms of what the Conservatives are actually doing. I mean, the idea that they're actually fixing social care is just not true. They've increased a tax that they're going to put largely into the NHS, which I think is going to be impossible to claw back from the NHS, and which isn't improving social care at all. So, I mean, that's just one example. And then it was a speech that had one policy announced in it, which was this £3,000 levelling up premium to encourage STEM teachers to go to unpopular areas where, you know, schools have shortages. Fine, that's great, but it's not commensurate with the challenge of levelling up the different parts of the United Kingdom that Boris Johnson promised when he became Prime Minister. All of that said, Boris Johnson clearly has the confidence that none of that matters and that he can appear what other people would, you know, another politician would be described as delusional, basically, that everything's going to be fine. You know, there's no shortages. Farmers aren't shooting their pigs because there's nowhere to slaughter them. You know, that actually the Tory faithful will forgive him. But also, I think he clearly assumes that the electorate won't end up blaming him either.
It was interesting. And inevitably, I suppose, that upbeat Boris Johnson, it was a classic Boris Johnson speech. Lots of jokes, actually lots of him just saying things which sound like jokes and they all laugh along, but almost no content.
Yeah, I mean, there was one point where he made a joke that I didn't think was very funny. I can't remember what it was because it was so rubbish, but they all laughed. And I just suddenly thought, well, actually, I mean, they really will laugh at anything he says, won't they? Even if he's announcing, like, a really boring policy on engineering, they'll probably think it's a joke. And so he does have so much goodwill in the party. Imagine if Theresa May were Prime Minister right now during these shortages. Imagine how, you know, frantic the cabinet would be. They'd be all running off the stage to say, that was terrible, that was terrible. Whereas everyone's just really happy because it's Boris Johnson. He does have an incredible ability to cheer people up and to get away with things that most politicians will never, ever have.
One of the standout things, I thought, was that the way that Boris Johnson once again tried to disguise the fact that the Conservatives have been in government for now 11 years. Let's take a listen to basically attack on his predecessors, Theresa May.
That's the difference between this radical and optimistic Conservatism and a tired old Labour. Did you see them last week? Did you watch them last week in Brighton? Hopelessly divided, I thought they looked. Their leader, like a seriously rattled bus conductor, pushed this way and that by a... Not that they have bus conductors anymore, unfortunately, but like a seriously rattled bus conductor, pushed this way and that by a Corbynista mob of sellotape-spectacled sans-culottes, or the skipper of a cruise liner that's been captured by Somali pirates, desperately trying to negotiate a change of course and then changing his mind.
That, in fact, of course, was an attack on the Labour Party rather than on his predecessors. We'll come to his predecessors in a moment. What did you make of Patrick Maguire? What did you make of the attacks on the Labour Party? Lots of Captain Hindsight again. It's basically still sticking to the same attacks he's used before.
Yeah, there were two main veins of criticism of the Labour Party. The first less significant, I would say, are the brief attacks on policy. For instance, you're saying if it were up to Keir Starmer, we'd still be in lockdown, cast them as opponents as levelling up. But the second, and far more prevalent and prominent, was, you know, what you might say, this was sort of government by telegraph column, right? He, as ever, as he's done for the best part of three decades, cast himself as the opponent of nannying lefties. You know, there was the very telling reference to Labour want children to run races in which there are no winners, which is, you know, he mentioned Thatcher early in the speech, is the sort of criticism people on the right used to make of the Ken Livingstone's Greater London Council. And I think that sort of, that criticism of the left is sort of very significant, right? Because he casts himself as a doer, an optimist, someone who's delivering, while, you know, as he said, Labour is divided, turning in on itself, arguing. But also, and this is something people around Keir Starmer are very alive to, that Labour are, you know, losers who are more interested in criticising the behaviour of the British people than getting behind it. And Boris Johnson is occupying a huge swathe of a political ground here. On the one hand, he's saying more cash for the NHS, on the other, and raising the minimum wage. On the other, he's talking about controlling immigration. And it's really difficult for Labour to find, to carve out the political space to oppose that vision, especially if, you know, as Tory ministers this week have been talking constantly about what Keir Starmer said last week about 100,000 visas for lorry drivers. If Labour aren't careful, they're going to end up in a space in 2024 where it's essentially a rerun of the Brexit referendum in 2016, where you have Boris Johnson talking about high wages, low immigration, and Labour are cast as at once a party of nannying losers and also, Redux Remainers. And it's really tricky. But as Isabel was saying before, where Labour can hit back on that is delivery, right? It's quite risky for Boris Johnson to cast himself as the man who is solving all of these incredibly knotty policy issues that successive governments have put in the sort of too difficult box. And Boris Johnson's gamble is that in at least speaking about them with gumption and brio, the public will appreciate that if they don't, even if solutions are not immediately forthcoming. But that's the political risk.
Let's turn our attention to what he said about his predecessors. He said, "I'm pleased to say that after years of stagnation, more than a decade, just happens to be the length of time the Conservatives have been in power, wages are going up." He later said, "We are dealing with the biggest underlying issues of our economy and society, the problems that no government has had the guts to tackle before." It's quite unusual for a Prime Minister to attack their own party's record in government in this way, albeit not explicitly, Chris Curtis.
Yeah, and there's a very important strategic reason why he's doing that. In 2023, 2024, whenever the next election comes around, the Conservatives will have been in power for well over a decade. The Conservatives will have fought, and to a more or lesser extent, won four general elections, be going for a fifth. And it's very, very hard thing to do that, to sort of reinvent yourself and sort of put out a new vision for the country when you've been in government for so long. And that's why he's trying to distance himself from his predecessors. That's why he's trying to make it out like this is a new government, different from Theresa May, from David Cameron's. But actually the more interesting thing, I thought, was not just that he was doing that, which is obvious and is an important part of what he needs to do, but he was doing that in front of a crowd of people who went out and door knocked for them, who went out and campaigned in the rain and in the cold and then parts of the country in the snow in for 2017, 2015 elections for these prime ministers that he's now going out and trashing. And when he said it, they all cheered and clapped.
But not only that, several of them sat in the cabinet of those governments. They didn't have the guts to tackle these issues.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's amazing, and yet he seems to be just doing it so incredibly successfully.
It's a reminder of this party's like protean capacity for reinvention. Mm. And the key thing, the key difference, last week we were talking about Labour members and trade unions and rule changes. We're sitting at what is a business networking event with some speeches by cabinet ministers. Mm. You know, it's a reminder that actually, at the end of the day, Boris Johnson doesn't have to listen to CLP secretaries and all that nonsense.
Do you remember after the 2019 election talking to a lot of senior Conservatives who said that they felt as though they were able to pitch themselves as a party that was coming into power afresh, rather than, you know, as we've just said, one that had been in power for nearly a decade at that point? And there was this real optimism that people are just going to see it as this new Boris Johnson party. And then COVID happened and they forgot all about that. And it's as though they've been really sort of, in terms of campaigning, in suspended animation. And they're just going straight back to this, we're the new Tories, a bit like we're New Labour. But I have to say, New Labour had policies that they talked about when they rebranded themselves, whereas a rebrand that involves just one policy that's £3,000 premium. I know I keep going on about it, but it's not really a big wow. This is what the Conservatives now stand for. You know, this levelling up premium. Now I understand their new brand.
And looking ahead, then, in a couple of weeks, we've got the spending review and the budget, which is actually probably going to be a much more significant event in terms of news generation and public interest, or certainly the impact on the public.
Less karaoke, though.
Less karaoke, all being well. What are the risks, do you think, in the next... Let's say between now and Christmas, Chris Curtis, in my opinion. What are the potential risks for Boris Johnson, do you think?
Well, there was surprisingly little in that speech about cost of living and the difficulties that people are facing. And, you know, it was a very, very good after-dinner speech. It was very positive and optimistic, like Isabel was saying. But I think the big risk for them is that that speech just looks so different from the reality that most people are going to be facing. You know, people woke up today on universal credit significantly poorer. They're going to be taking home less. Yeah, they're going to have less money in their bank accounts next week than they had last week. And the Prime Minister took to a stage and gave this, isn't everything great? We're building back better. We're optimistic for the future. They're not necessarily going to be feeling that. So I think that's the big threat for them. And I suppose the big thing to watch out for, as we saw on the front page of the Times this morning, is what's going to happen on the minimum wage. So much has been talking about wages and wages going up and a high wage economy. I can't see any way that strategy does not end in a significant uplift in the minimum wage coming in the coming months.
Isabel, the risks in the next few months for the government?
Yeah,
I mean, and how do Labour capitalise on that? Because, I mean, the other thing is we've had all this crisis, and even having the political media's attention on Labour last week, they failed to capitalise on it.
They were so flat-footed that I think they should have cancelled their conference, or at least rewritten their entire conference just to be about the fuel crisis and cost of living, rather than sort of sticking rigidly onto the train tracks that they'd planned months before. So Labour aren't going to really capitalise on this. I suspect that Keir Starmer will keep doing what he's done for ages, and 2 weeks after something has become a problem, start calling for it to be solved, which just makes him appear, you know, as out of touch in a different way as the Tories could be. But I think it is going to be really difficult this winter. And I don't think that... Boris Johnson came on and quite early on said, it's all okay now. Now, he was talking about COVID, which isn't going to be okay this winter. Actually, that's one problem. But the supply chain shortages are also not going to be okay. People had a rubbish Christmas last year. They're quite looking forward to a good Christmas this year. They're going to be quite upset if they can't fill their car up, or they can't, you know, well, maybe they should buy something that's nicer than turkey anyway, but if they can't get their prized Christmas meat this Christmas, then people are going to be upset. And at some point, possibly, Boris Johnson may start to get the blame. Possibly.
Patrick McGuire?
I think Chris is absolutely right to raise the universal credit uplift, because I think it plays into the levelling up thing in a big way. It's really interesting to hear, you know, in the Boris pastoral bit of the speech, Boris Johnson quoting that Thomas Gray poem about Stoke Poges, two words that then lost all meaning as he bludgeoned the audience by saying them again and again and again. But it's interesting, right? He's talking about levelling up and making a very powerful argument that the circumstances of your birth shouldn't constrain your life opportunities, on a day where the Treasury, at the behest of the Treasury, classic Treasury orthodoxy, are pushing through a welfare cut that is going to hit disproportionately people in the regions Boris Johnson is pledging to level up. Now, we'll look at the spending review. Michael Gove's entire brief and the entire, the whole levelling up thing is going to be completely meaningless without a substantial injection of cash into that department. And given what we know about Rishi Sunak, given what we heard him talking about, the immorality of funding government's fiscal policy through borrowing, it's going to be really interesting to see if they can square the circle of what Rishi Sunak thinks the government's fiscal policy should look like and Boris Johnson's rhetoric of levelling up. But say they do, that's also a political risk for Labour. Michael Gove speaks the other day talking all about not only creating new mayors, but devolving more power to existing mayors. At that point, the most compelling figures in the Labour Party, i.e. its regional mayors, will be in a position where they have even more power. Your Andy Burnhams, your Sadiq Khans will look like even more substantial figures than Keir Starmer. And imagine the optics of that, you know. There's that famous cartoon, isn't there, I'm not for a moment comparing Andy Burnham and Boris Johnson to Stalin and Hitler. But you know where, you know, they're they're shaking hands, you know, the scum of the earth, I believe, and the bloody assassin of the workers, I presume. The optics of of Andy Burnham and Sadiq Khan and Boris Johnson and Michael Gove announcing a new devolution deal. Keir Starmer totally frozen out. It's sort of, you know, the reconfiguration of British politics along regional lines, rather than, and with Keir Starmer in the middle looking sort of powerless and impotent. It'll be really, really, really interesting if Michael Gove is given money and a brief to properly devolve power. The Labour Party in Westminster will look increasingly irrelevant.
Well, the Labour Party have responded to the speech of the last few minutes, saying Build Back Better is an empty promise. Here's why. 6 million families face a cut to universal credit. National insurance up. Energy prices up. Supermarket shelves empty. The Tories are not delivering for Britain. That from the Labour Party. The SNP saying Boris Johnson's shameless attempt to shift the blame onto anyone but himself will do nothing to fix the crisis he's caused with his disastrous hard Brexit and Tory cruel Tory cuts. So that's some of the political reaction to Boris Johnson's speech. One last thing, just so we can hear it and then never, ever hear it again. One of the most alarming bits, I think, was when he turned his attention to wildlife.
We're planting tens of millions of trees. Otters are returning to rivers from which they've been absent for decades. Beavers that have not been seen on some rivers since Tudor times, massacred for their pelts and now back. And if that isn't conservatism, my friends, I don't know what is. Build Back Beaver, I say.
Chris Curtis has got his head in his hands at the prospect of Build Back Beaver.
How do beavers poll, Chris? Are they a popular animal?
What?
We'll have to run that in the coming days.
Yes. You should.
We'll come up with 10 animals and we'll find out who's the most popular. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth Tree Dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Runner, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.